Okay.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And Bruce, we're at a different time now. How do you feel about this?
Well, I slept in an extra hour, which is kind of nice.
I know, it's kind of cool. You know, it's only 7 o'clock in the morning, so
actually 6 was fine, but 7's really nice. So yeah,
it's kind of fun actually to roll out of bed and just come in here and start talking.
Oh yeah.
Oh my gosh. So what's going on with you this week? Anything interesting? We haven't talked in a couple weeks actually, because
it's been a couple weeks. Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Meeting with some friends tomorrow. There's an agate festival here, and I'll be doing a bunch of little miscellaneous projects and a new collaboration that I'll share more about when it's underway. And lots of fun stuff. So how about you?
You know, just still working on writing my book, getting ready to go to San Francisco this week. I'm going to be going to a wellness event in San Francisco, so I'll be leaving on Wednesday. I probably will not be with you on Saturday, I'm thinking, because I'll be at that event.
Oh, okay.
So just thinking of that. And then going to take the train or something down to see Veronica Gabrielle. So I'll be staying at Rev. Tony Ponticello's house in San Francisco.
Oh,
and
nice.
Then meeting up with Roxy and Rev. Kelly, and probably, you know, going out and checking out some stuff in San Francisco. They're quite excited. And so, yeah, it's going to be kind of fun. Yeah, so I'll be gone a whole week. So,
well, happy travels.
Oh, thank you. And then, of course, in February, Dove and I are speaking at the Course in Miracles conference in San Francisco again, going to San Francisco. So that is the last part of February, and there's still tickets available if anybody wants to. Pony up and go, and it's going to be a lot of fun. There's going to be a lot of Bob Rosenthal is going to be there.
Yes.
And Tamla Morgan. Yeah. So that's kind of a cool crossover now, because, you know, there has been some, you know, between the Community Miracle Centers and the foundation, a little bit of unrest there, I think, for a while. But I'm glad to see that the bridges are being built and we're actually coming together.
or metaphorically, the bridges have always been there between all of us. We've just piled a few barricades in the way in our minds only.
Exactly. And you know, it's interesting because, you know, today I was just talking about today's lesson, which is lesson 13, and it's all about these this meaningless world and this meaningless all these meaningless everything that we've given so much meaning to, that, you know, may put us into a place where we're afraid of everything. I mean, that's the ego's plan.
Yeah, exactly.
It makes you totally afraid. So it says, you know, you got to be careful about your health. You know, if you got high cholesterol, you better stop eating butter. You need to dress a certain way, look a certain way, marry a certain kind of person. Your relationship should be like this. If he doesn't give you roses on Valentine's Day, then, you know, you can, you know, throw a fit and you know, be mean. You know, and they're all the meanings that the world has given us for how our relationship should be, how we should think, what we should do. When we start looking at all of those relationships and all of those thoughts and all of those rules, that were not the rules or the laws that God made, but they're the laws that the ego made in order to keep us safe in this world, as in we follow its rules and we won't get hurt. But, of course, the rules of the ego engender nothing but suffering, because that's the purpose. Have you watched this show called The Good Place by any chance?
I think you've mentioned it. I haven't, but anyway.
Well, anyway, it's so funny because the place where they're at has been made to make them suffer. And so they point out all these different ways that even from the, which I shouldn't spoil it, but from the very beginning, the, the first, when they come to this place, every place is a frozen yogurt place. There's frozen yogurt everywhere. And it's because the question was, what is something that you think is going to be great when you start to eat it, but realize is going to be disappointing? And it becomes disappointing almost immediately. And it's frozen yogurt. So, you know, that's what this world is, you know, setting us up to think that something's going to be a certain way and then getting disappointed because it's not. And then relying then on, more ego ploys to try to energize myself, make myself feel better. So I go and eat Baskin Robbins ice cream or something instead. So, anyway, the point being the whole world, it's all set up to be a failure and to disappoint us. And, so, you know, that's, and it's all meaningless and we've given it all this meaning that is really only to keep us in the dream. Keep
yeah,
us dreaming.
Exactly. A quick aside, since you mentioned Baskin Robbins, years ago, growing up in Livermore, California, I acquired a number of stickers, which I have no idea where they are now, but it's been a few decades, that said Baskin Robbins United Closet Eaters, because they had a little marketing campaign. And, of course, the acronym was Bruce, and so I had to have a bunch of the stickers. But I was thinking about that now. It's sort of symbolic of, you know, a united closet eater. Well, okay, we're all, you know, furtively doing things that we think are going to make us happy in the dream. And I hadn't even thought about it until you mentioned it just now. You know, what the ego's symbolic meaning of that would be, oh, you can get away with murder essentially, and that's the whole strategy of the ego, is that we project onto the rest of the world the things that we think we secretly in our secret dream think that we've, you know, committed these egregious sins against perfect oneness, and yet nothing really happened. And all of our attempts to try to satiate ourselves and have, you know, fleeting pleasures and avoid the pains, the inevitable pains that the ego thinks are going to do us in, you know, are just silly. You know, it's just this standard crazy fare. And anyway.
And we all live through it.
Yeah.
And we continue. That's what I think, you know, all the greatest fears I ever had, and, you know, every worry I ever had, I read this somewhere, and I think it's absolutely true. My projection of what was going to happen was far worse than anything that actually ever happened. And, in, you know, you may think, well, you know, I can't imagine the worst thing. Well, yeah, you can imagine all sorts of things happening, and the fear of what you think is going to happen, even living through that, is the punishment as well. So by the time the event happens, you realize that was nothing. You know, everything I've ever thought was going to just destroy me as a person because it was just so devastating. When it happened, or when whatever happened, you know, as the result of whatever was going on, it was never, never as bad. It couldn't possibly be. So, you know, it's the anticipation. It's those arrows you're slinging at yourself the whole time. You know, you hurt yourself with things. It's amazing to me that that's not so much more evident until you really start looking for it. How we misunderstood that, I don't know. Anyway, so so shall we go on with reading our book?
Sure.
And go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, in response to what you just shared, I was just going to – I quickly Googled a favorite quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson, which fits very nicely, which is, some of your hurts you have cured, and the sharpest you've even survived. But what torments of grief you've endured from evils which never arrived. Anyway, I think that little short poem is summarizes, you know, the ego's fear-mongering strategy very nicely.
Can you post that?
Sure.
Then I can write that in the room.
You betcha. Yeah, I'll just put it in the chat window here. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, because and that's it exactly. It's the imagination of what could happen that causes the grief and causes fear. And when you stop imagining, guess what? you no longer have that that pain and that fear.
Yeah. There's another quote from Mark Twain that I usually paraphrase, but it's something to the effect of, there's been a lot of tragedy in my life, and some of it actually happened.
Exactly. Oh, brilliant.
And of course, the correction that A Course in Miracles would make is, none of it happened. So it was, you know, Twain was close, but but it's actually it was none of it happened, because we made it all up in our mind. So, and I'm certainly in need of those reminders, because I fret about things in the dream world, as my wife will testify, those who know me. You know, I just like everybody else, you know, we all have these things that we think are, you know, stuff we need to fret and fuss about. But then when we get around to really confronting the cause and, you know, going through those double shield of oblivion through the world to the mind. In fact, there's a little quote one more quote du jour. This is from Jeffrey Siebert, who does these wonderful, with Rosemary Lasasso, these wonderful streaming seminars, of which there is one more coming up in a couple of weeks here, that you can still, I think, register for, the very last one, and they're probably going to take a, I'm not sure if it's going to be a long hiatus or if it's just something that's going to be a quote unquote permanent thing. But anyway, these streaming webinars that they've done for several years now have just been brilliant, from the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, from which Lynn and I have read the from the Frequently Asked Questions for several years, and we'll probably get back to that after we, you know, finish Gary's fourth book. Anyway, this is a quote from Jeffrey Siebert from one of these webinars. The world was made to hide the guilt. The guilt was made to hide the innocence. I think that just perfectly summarizes the double shield of oblivion that A Course in Miracles talks about.
Oh, yeah, that is perfect. And that is exactly really, that's exactly what happened. So, I am kind of wondering too what's going to be happening with the classes from the foundation, but I'm sure that they're going to come up with, some other, you know, because I can't see that legacy being, forgotten. You know, there's just so much wealth there.
Yeah. But, I'm sure it'll resurface in some other form. Yeah.
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 Okay. So, all right. So we are in Gary Renard's new book, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other. It's real interesting. I'm in the Awakening Together Buddhism class now for the ministerial program. So I'm reading Thich Nhat Hanh's book about Buddha. Uh-huh. And not about Buddha. It's called The Heart of the Buddha. But it's a very interesting juxtaposition here.
Yeah, I bet.
So last week, or the last time we ended, I think we were going to go back a paragraph.
I think going back a page wouldn't hurt, to the top of page 7. What do you think?
That's a good idea. I think that would be great.
Because that's right when Arden and Persa begin their conversation with Gary.
Okay. So since I am on the Kindle here, why don't you start and then I'll catch up to you where you're at.
Okay, yeah. If you just search for Arden and Caps, you'll the first instance of that, you'll find it, which is now, again, to recap, Lynn and I are reading from Gary Renard's fourth book, Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions. And this has been out for a few months now. And shameless promotion plug aside is that I have some course related books on aciandblog.com, and I get a small affiliate commission if anybody orders books from there, and it's the same price to you. So if you happen to be ordering one, so if you want to get a copy, you can snag one there. So anyway, so Arden starts out. This is Gary, one of Gary's two teachers, Arden and Persa, who are featured in all four of his books now. Arden says, "Hey, bro, you've had a busy year. Congrats on the new book being out." And this is after his third book was just out. And then Gary says, "Thanks, but I should congratulate you. After all, the best parts of it come from you guys." Arden, "Oh, I don't know. As one of your readers wrote to you, you're not our water boy anymore." Gary, "And how are you, my unattainable beauty?" Persa, "Still unattainable. So let's get down to business, shall we?" Gary, "You sound serious. Is something urgent?" Persa, "Not really, but we want to emphasize to you, that the reason we keep visiting you is to help people keep the process going of undoing their egos and accelerating that process. The undoing of the ego takes time, and it's easy for people to get distracted in many different ways. We'll point out some of the ways, some of those ways as we go along. Art, and don't forget, that takes a considerable, that takes a combination, a combination of repetition and the introduction of new ideas. You'll be hearing both. So tell me, how are you doing forgiving your critics, Gary? Pretty good. Besides, you know what they say about critics. Arden, no. Gary, what do they say about critics? Gary, critics are like eunuchs in a harem. They see it performed every night, but they can't do it themselves. Persa, that's not exactly what Arden meant by forgiving, but I appreciate the humor. Do you want to go on from there?
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Mm-hmm. I always love these little analogies. And okay, so Gary, you know, Cindy and I had lunch once in Wilshire with this guy named John, who she graduated with from the University of Santa Monica. The conversation turned to the fact that there are a lot of angry, negative people out there on the internet. And he said something that really struck me. He said, I'm hearing something here. Hang on.
Okay.
I think something is playing on my internet here, and I'm just
okay.
Well, I can't find it. It doesn't matter. Okay, as long as it's not on the recording. Okay. All right. The conversation turned to the fact that there are a lot of angry, negative people out there on the internet, and he said something that really struck me. He said, "Gary, you've got two kinds of people. You got your people, and you got your people, and not your people." Why waste your time and energy responding to or thinking about the ones who are not your people? Don't bother. Oh, yes. There is something playing. It's like, what? I was hearing Spanish. Okay.
Shall I read while you're looking?
No, I got it. Popped up and was playing. Okay. Don't bother. They're not going to change their minds anyway, not until they're ready to. What you want to do is spend your time and energy with the ones who are your people. Then your efforts will always be well spent. That made a lot of practical sense to me. And yes, forgiveness is even deeper. And I just want to comment on that particular discussion. It's not so much that you want to avoid people who are not your people and always go to the people who are your people. To me, it's you need to learn the lesson about why it is that those are not your people, that you have an idea that some people are your people and other people are not. Although, like Buddhism, which is what I'm studying now with Regina, will say that the best thing to do is to cling to the Sangha, you know, and to, you know, put yourself in a place where you're going to be more likely to be stimulated to think good thoughts, which is what this paragraph is saying. So you have I kind of have a mixed thought about that, because when I get with my brother who irritates the hell out of me, then that gives me a chance to recognize my thinking and practice forgiveness. But if I'm around those people all the time, I might tend to get a little bit grumpy. So, you know, maybe there's a balance. I don't know. Anyway, just my thought. All right, you want me to continue reading? Okay, and Bruce has posted here, and then I'll post it in the room. Get to it.
Okay. Yeah, I just posted a couple of things. One was the quote from Jeffrey Siebert that I mentioned earlier, and the other was since we were talking about, you know, dividing people into two types. I shared my favorite sub-law of Murphy's Laws that went around the office I worked in about 30 years ago now, before the internet, which is on pieces of photocopied paper. It was all these sub-laws of Murphy's Law, and one of them that I thought was the most zen was, there are two types of people in the world, those who divide people into two types and those who don't. that was called Garth's distinction, so presumably there's somebody named Garth who made that up, but anyway, I always try to give credit where it's due. But I just thought that was a fun maxim to remember the two thought systems. You know, the ego always wants to divide, and the Holy Spirit sees that there's no division and gently reminds us that that's, you know, a silly misperception. And, you know, on the level of form, of course, everything is divided, and there's nothing is truly the same. But that's part of its facade of nothingness, where in even modern physics tells us that everything is truly the same, and there's just one thing that appears to be divided into, you know, countless seemingly separate things, from quarks to quasars, and as Einstein said, you know, the optical delusion of consciousness that seems to make us at the mercy of separation, but it's just a dream, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And so, you know, it's just unraveling our imaginary thoughts about what is happening here. Exactly. So you want me to continue reading, or you want to pick up?
I'll pick up if you want. Okay. First up, well, we're going to be going pretty deep with you during the series of visits, my brother, and we're going to be doing it in a way that we know you've been waiting for. Gary, I knew it. You've been picking up on the fact that I want to know how Jesus got to be Jesus. Of course, I'll call him Jay, and while we're at it, how did Buddha get to be Buddha? What were their dream lifetimes like before that? What did they learn and apply? We all know an ounce of application is worth a pound of knowledge. Persa, it sure is, and you're asking an appropriate question. When a master like Jay comes back for his final lifetime, it's not like he has a big learning curve. He already knows everything he has to know in order to be enlightened. That story of Jay teaching the rabbis in the temple when he was 12 years old is true. They even called him rabbi, which means teacher. He already knew everything. There were just a couple of big lessons that were appropriate for him to teach and learn during that lifetime, including, of course, the crucifixion. Arden, another reason a master comes back for his or her final lifetime is to be there for others. Many people simply need to be pointed in the right direction. The master can't do the student's mental work for them. They have to do that. And the student cannot be enlightened simply by being in the presence of a master, even though some of them would like for that to be true. But the master can point the way. That's what Jay, the wisdom teacher, who really appeared to exist in this world 2,000 years ago, was doing, pointing people in the right direction. Not starting a religion, but pointing the way. You may recall that we once described him as a light leading the children home to the kingdom of heaven. Persa, you could also say that's exactly what he's doing today with A Course in Miracles. It's like he's saying, look, this is what worked for me. Maybe you should check it out. Maybe you'll save yourself a few thousand years. And as you know, he's often quite forceful in the Course with his teaching style. He's relentlessly uncompromising. Gary, I noticed, and people are always trying to compromise on the Course.
I just wanted to just mention something while we're talking about, you know, Gary wondering, which I wondered also, and which many people wonder, how did Jesus do this? If Jesus was the first one who accepted the atonement for himself, what was the process that he used? And it's interesting to me, someone was on talking last night about the Urantia book. And the Urantia book has this whole story of Jesus' life from the time he was a child. I just read an article that there's proof that he went to India and studied with, you know, these monks or whatever, and went through all this stuff. I read.
Wasn't a selfie and a photo that surfaced from Bangalore with a bunch of buddies or something like that? No, nothing like that.
Okay. But it was, you know, pretty well researched article, or that, you know, like you read J.M., The Way of Mastery. He explains how he did it there. Every time, all these explanations are different about, you know, how he did it. But, you know, I believe what he says in A Course in Miracles, and I think it's, you know, pretty simple. I it is more than likely he was ready for that kind of thinking, because, you know, he could see the Christ in his brother, which is almost impossible if you're fully engaged in ego. So somehow or the other, he was able to recognize the difference and step out of that ego mind and into the Christ mind. And that's really all we need to know. How do you do that? I think, you know, this is an interesting discussion. And, you know, I tend to believe what he says in the Course. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Because I think him.
Although it's interesting, he in his Course, alluding to Jay, he says you don't have to believe it or even welcome it. You just have to try it. You know, you just have to be willing to, you know, suspend the disbelief long enough to you know, consider the idea that maybe practicing without even trying to believe or not believe anything might help. And, you know, if you're willing to give it a go, you know, you'll discover that it does work. But the challenge, like he told Helen, is that, you know, how often do we actually really practice it consistently? And I think that's what Martin and Persia came back to help Gary and all of us remember, as well as the Course, that, you know, we just need to keep at it. And, you know, the repetition of good ideas and the practice of forgiveness is really our way out of the ego's quagmire, huh?
Exactly. And what it does is as you begin to practice it, you begin to see more opportunities to practice it, and it becomes generalized into your life, so that everything that appears and happens, you hear, you think, your maybe not your first thought after a while, maybe, but you know, one of your thoughts along the way is maybe forgiveness would work in this situation. And you know, no matter how many other paths you go down while you're trying to figure out how to work through a problem, if you eventually get to forgiveness and recognize, oh, that did work, then you get closer and closer to doing that every time, maybe the first time, the first opportunity you have to, you know, figure something out, rather than, you know, trying it your own way 50 times and causing yourself nothing but frustration, and then realizing, oh, geez, I could have had a V8. I could ask the Holy Spirit. I could, you know, mm-hmm. And honestly, we are just so silly and stubborn. Anyway.
Yeah. So, I also like to think of the practical metric of, and it really isn't even a metric. It's just kind of a, you know, because time is a perceptual thing. But, you know, in a pragmatic sense, you know, the misery duration factor is how long do I want to be miserable? And the quicker we choose forgiveness, the real forgiveness that, you know, reminds us that nothing happened to our real identity. And so therefore all grievances are unfounded. That kind of forgiveness, if we can do that more quickly each time, then the accumulated amount of miserable self-image and experience is minimized, and eventually we'll get, you know, bored with abuse altogether, and just say, okay, I think I will, you know, try practicing this consistently rather than just now and then, and do it quicker. Yeah.
Exactly. And then you become happier sooner, and you get the rewards back and forth. And that's what I've noticed in my life, is that I'm rewarded for that kind of behavior, because I am no longer as afraid, which again, today, the lesson, my meaningless thoughts are showing me a meaningless world, mm-hmm. you know, and that's, you know, once you recognize, oh my gosh, I thought that was just so important. And now I see that, you know, I made a mountain out of a molehill here, which is my everyday life. Then you can just let it go. And that freedom is such a relief. Okay. So let's see. I'm going to read the last quote thing from Persa and go on. Okay. So, you could say that it's exactly what he's doing today with the Course in Miracles. It's like he's saying, look, this is what worked for me. Maybe you should check it out. Maybe you'll save yourself a few thousand years. And as you know, he's often quite forceful in the Course with his teaching style. He's relentlessly uncompromising. And then Gary says, I noticed, and people are always trying to compromise on the Course. Arjun, don't let that have any effect on you. It's just a dream, remember? and it's your dream, not somebody else's. There isn't anybody else. Persa, it's interesting that you've been asking about both Jay and Buddha. More interesting than you think. Gary, okay, I'll play along. Why is that? Persa, what if I told you that they knew each other in several lifetimes and even helped each other along the path? Gary, you're shitting me. I always thought of them as two completely separate beings because their cultures were so different. Artin, you'll find that in the end, their cultures were really the only thing that was different about them. Ultimately, we are all one, and we have a few surprises for you along the way. Gary, by now I'd be shocked if you didn't. But tell me, how did they help each other along the path? And so, you know, this is interesting that they're telling him, yep, they hung out together, they knew each other, and somehow, you know, they had relationships that helped them. And the course does say that that is the case, that there are teachers. We've known each other. We have passed each other through different lifetimes or scenarios, and we come together over and over. So that makes sense to me that they would be telling him this.
And just as a quick aside, if there's only one of us, how could we not be all destined to meet? And, you know, that kind of puts the kibosh on both special love and special hate. If there's just one being, then, you know, specialness of any kind is just silly, isn't it?
Well, that's absolutely the case. And yes, because we're all living out this scenario. That's why everybody was Cleopatra, and everybody was, I don't know, a lot of people say they were Attila the Hun, or they, you know, we are all these people, because there's only one of us who's playing out all these parts. And, you know, I don't know dynamically how it works, because it's a dream.
I was just going to say, and since what we're all doing is reviewing what's already gone by, so are our current dream figures that we see on TV every day and hear in the news and you know, see in our households and communities and et cetera, et cetera. they're also figures that are us, that appear to be outside of us. So it's important to remember.
Yeah, and what helps me with that is recognizing that the only thing I really know about those figures is the thoughts in my mind, that I don't really know anything beyond what my mind thinks about them. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they think about themselves. I have no idea, you know, what they think I am. I have no idea anything. It's all what I think is happening. And it's all my own perception. And recognizing that, then what am I not perceiving? The Christ is what they truly are. So I'm making up a story about I'm making up a screen to protect me from actually seeing the Christ. I'm making up a screen that's a personality, that's a face, that's a voice, that's a you know, a mannerism. I'm making all that up and attributing it to something that it doesn't even belong to. So. Yeah, it's interesting when you start thinking about the illusion and the dream, because yes, in reality, it is all just the Son of God and the Christ. Mm-hmm. So if you could get past the illusion, you would know that.
Yeah, and as you're saying that, I was thinking, you know, the ego's prop department for its movie is always, you know, the one thing it can draw from is distorted interpretations of distorted, perceptions, right? I mean, and limited perceptions.
That's it. That's really all it. And what's so funny is that it is, we made it up to be that way, and we expect it to be that way. And so when we look, we see that, when in reality it doesn't even exist. We're just visioning our expectation of what should be there. So, you know, you think like the periodic table, or you think, you know, when we're exploring space and we think, oh, there should be something there because this is here and this is here and this is like the periodic table. We, you know, we didn't know all the elements, but we lined them up and we said, oh, here's spots and holes. There should be something here. And lo and behold, later on, we discover it. Oh, yeah, there it is. It belonged there. You know, did we make that because we expected it, or was it part of the natural part way of it? It's all the same thing. It's all an illusion. We're projecting it, and then we're believing it. We're making it up, and then we believe it's making us up. It's insane.
Mm-hmm. Truly, truly, isn't it? Do you want to read some more?
Yeah, where are we at here?
About Persa, we're going to be going pretty deep with you.
Okay. Let me, when I click on things, suddenly it's, okay, here we go. Persa, well, we're going to be going pretty deep with you. Oh, poop. Okay. I'll move you over. During this series of visits, my brother, and we're going to be doing it in a way we know you've been waiting for. Gary, I knew it. You've been picking up on the fact that I want to know how Jesus got to be Jesus. Of course, I'll call him Jay. And while we're at it, how did Buddha get to be Buddha? What were their dream lifetimes like the time before that? Oh,
you know what? We already read this, didn't we? I think I went back a page.
Okay. I thought I just read this too, but I thought maybe I was reading ahead when you were talking.
No. I think I got off track too. Okay. In terms of where we left off.
All right. So yeah, you're right, because I was going to get into reading that. Okay.
Yep.
All right. So
I think we got to.
You could say that's exactly what he's doing today with the Course of Miracles.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's see. Oh yeah, I read that already too.
I think we got down to let's see. Gary, say it. Right.
Let's see.
About there. Let's see.
Why don't you just? I remember reading.
I'll pick up about where we left off. It says,
okay. All right.
I'll start with Gary. By now, I'd be shocked if you didn't, which is basically say something. A few surprises. But tell me, how did they help each other along the path? Arden, explaining that will be gradual because enlightenment in the illusion comes gradually. Even Jay and Buddha started out at the bottom, except they had one great advantage over others that guaranteed the two of them would get home quicker than anyone else. Gary, say it. They didn't buy into the dream as much as other beings did. Yes, they believed it at first, but they didn't believe it as much. They had doubts from the beginning that the dream had substance and sensed that only an insane God would make an insane world. They also sensed that God was not insane and that something was amiss. Persa, that simple advantage was huge, and you don't have to be them to learn it. But they learned it before others because they had already sensed it. Arden, yes, but they still had to climb back up the ladder to enlightenment. Gary, I don't remember much in the course about a ladder. Arden, actually it's in there a few times. For example, what waits in perfect certainty beyond salvation is not our concern. For you have barely started to allow your first uncertain steps to be directed up the ladder. Separation led you down. And then everyone who thinks they're here climbed down the illusory ladder of separation. In fact, it's the experience of separation from your source, which is God, that's the problem. At other times, we've gone into how the separation seemed to occur, so we won't repeat it here. But the place where all people who begin a sincere spiritual search find themselves is right at the lowest rung of the ladder, steeped in a condition of duality. Duality means you believe there's a world outside of you. So you believe in a subject and an object. There's you and the world. Before you climbed down the ladder, there was only perfect oneness. There was only God. But now you're stuck in a condition of two-ness. There's you and God. That's true for people who believe in God. If they don't, then it's themselves and the world. Either way or both ways, they believe in separation. And the word believe is paramount here. As we emphasized in the last series of visits, it's your belief in the world that gives it power over you. Your belief puts you at the effect of it. And if you're at the effect of the world, it will have an effect on you. Jay and Buddha, on the other hand, didn't believe in it as much as the others did.
You know, I find that really interesting because that's my experience. My entire life has been one of thinking that I was in a dream and not experiencing not consistently, not all the time, but I would have these feelings, and I'm sure you have too, where you're just like, wait a minute, is what is happening? Is this real or is this, I just feel like I'm dreaming. And sometimes when I was a kid, I would look at things like the mountains. You know, I grew up in Leadville, which is like really, you know, you're surrounded by mountains. And I would look around and it would look like everything was made out of cardboard. And I would wonder, you know, how, why is that? That, you know, it just seems so unreal. I think that's a common experience that people have, and we don't have to go to Leadville. Yeah, really. you don't have to think, you know, maybe your ego just says, nope, you can't think that. No. And, you know, sends you into denial when you have those experiences. But everyone's had them, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This, just noticing the surreality of your experience in this world. And even if it doesn't resolve into a, you know, more specific question of there's got to be a better way, even just that feeling like, well, you know, there's something better than this. A moment ago when I was, reading what I just read, I was thinking back to, about 5-6 years ago when we'd first moved to Colorado and, we're running a place in Castle Rock, and a couple of missionaries came to the door. And rather than, you know, just ignoring them, I came to the door and talked with them for a few minutes. And I, you know, started just without trying to, you know, persuade or do anything. They were sharing some things with me. And I said, well, I guess the challenge I've had with, you know, formal religions, and this is paraphrasing what I said, but it's, I think the gist of it is that, at a fairly early age, I was starting to question the idea of a vengeful schizophrenic God, and that never made any sense to me, and that's why I kind of went some other directions. And they, after about a few seconds, they kind of politely looked at each other and walked away. but that was kind of, you know, but I wasn't trying to be, you know, mean or anything. I was just saying, well, this is what didn't make any sense to me, you know, and that's why, you know, I appreciate them doing what they're doing, but you know, it wasn't for me, and thank you very much, and you know.
Politely
agree to disagree kind of thing, but it wasn't any kind of hostility. It was just kind of like a matter of fact kind of here's you know what has been my perspective, you know, for quite a while now, and you know,
that's pretty funny. That's hilarious, in fact, because I've done the same thing myself, scared mm-hmm. people with my direction of, well, yeah, what you are telling me is insane, and think about it. And have a conversation with them about it. And I've had a lot of people that have come away just saying, you know, I don't know, you know, what I think now, because it makes no sense that God would be that way.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes no sense. And how they convince themselves that it is just insane and painful. You know, they really have to believe in punishment, and they really have to believe in, They must have a completely backwards idea of what love is and what love does. And, you know, that's a sad misinterpretation. But anyway, let's go on. So Persa, everyone's got to start somewhere, and dualism is a condition of 99% of the people in the world, including those who are on a spiritual path. But as you know, A Course in Miracles is not a dualistic system. And it's not just non-dualistic, it's purely non-dualistic, which we'll get to. That is why the Course says, be vigilant only for God and His kingdom. But that's a pretty tall order, which is why most students of the Course end up in some kind of dualistic quagmire and never go all the way with it, including those who are convinced that they're right about the Course making something exist other than God, when it certainly doesn't. Even Jay and Buddha, despite their advantage, had to appear to start in this world like everybody else, and will tell you how they did it. But because of their head start, they didn't make some of the same mistakes that most people do. So it really is coming to understanding of what really non-dual realm really means. And it's hard to do when you are living in a world where your experience is me and another. There's always got to be another. And that's the only reason we can exist in this world is the reflection or the belief that something else exists outside of myself. There always has to be another to reflect, even if that other is just me looking in the mirror. I'm seeing myself as two things.
You mentioned mirror, and I just happened to glance at my Skype screen, which shows a blue gradient fading down to a pink at the bottom of the screen, and I'm looking out the window, seeing sunrise over the ocean about to happen, and it's a blue gradient at the bottom going up to a pink sky above it, just the opposite. And I was thinking how symbolic of everything in this world we have upside down and backwards, and it's all distorted mirrors of things, isn't it? Anyway, just struck me funny.
It is. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It really is. All right.
Should I pick up or do you want to read on?
Sure. Why don't you pick up?
Okay. I'll recap the last short paragraph. So even Jay and Buddha, despite their advantage, had to appear to a start in this world like everybody else, and we'll tell you why they did it. But because of their head start, they didn't make some of the same mistakes that most people do. Gary, such as, that was Persa before, Persa resumes, one of the problems with the history of spiritual students is that they think they understand what a master is teaching when they don't. So someone will be with Lao Tzu, and after Lao Tzu is no longer seemingly hanging around a body, the student will say, this is what he said and this is what he meant by it. And invariably, the student will be coming from a place of dualism when the master was coming from a higher state. There's more than one higher state and more than one step on the ladder, which we'll get to. But most students want to be teachers instead of students. It feels special to be a leader instead of a follower. and I'm going to put he may get to this what we read this morning, but I always appreciate what Gary has commented on about Jesus being the ultimate follower rather than the ultimate leader. I think that's very important. Is you know, we need to really trust that awareness that we took with us into the dream that we call Holy Spirit or inner kindness teacher and whatever label, you know, works for us, but whatever represents that pure, uncompromising awareness that says that we can and are, out of the dream, can leave the dream and truly are already, but we need to practice forgiveness in order to return to that state. So.
Exactly. You just prompted me to think about are the lessons that we have. The one that says, I will take the second to gain the first.
Yeah.
And also I will step back and let him lead the way. It's all about stepping back from thinking that I'm my own leader and being the ultimate follower. You know, that is, you know, Jesus was the ultimate follower. He listened only for one voice. He followed on only one guide. Mm-hmm. And, God is not my co-pilot. You know, God is the pilot and I'm the co. So, you know, that's really, anyway, that's really makes a lot of sense to me. Anyway, continue on.
Okay. That's how religions get started. People think they understand Buddha, and so someday you end up with Buddhism. But Buddha didn't want to start a religion. People would ask him, what are you? And he would say, I'm awake. That's what he wanted for them, not hundreds of rituals to follow. He was a wisdom teacher. And, of course, everybody and their brother thought they knew what Jay was saying, or they had an agenda that led them to say something to the contrary. And someday you have a religion purported to be about him. Yet, like Buddha, a religion was not something Jay would be interested in. He was also a wisdom teacher. Artin. That's why most people in the West think of Jay as being the ultimate leader. Of course, he does recap what I just was thinking of. Okay, but just the opposite was true. He wasn't the ultimate leader. He was the ultimate follower. Why? Because he listened to the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit was the leader, not him. And eventually he listened to only the Holy Spirit. He was vigilant only for God and his kingdom, which is why he's advising you to do the same in the course, which is just what you were just sharing, huh, Lynn?
Exactly. Why do we waste our breath?
Well, because it bears repeating, right?
I guess
teachers would also remind us. Yeah. Yeah.
It is so perfect.
Yeah. Do you want to continue?
Yeah. So Gary says, so dualism generally leads to religions, or at least organizations that are falsely based on what the members imagine that a founder who may not have even wanted to be a founder was really all about. And so we made up a story about what Jesus said. So Persia says, well put, almost. Artin says, remember, one thing, everybody makes it real. As soon as people pray to a God that they imagine to be outside of themselves, they're making duality real. They're perpetuating the idea of separation without even realizing it. That is why enlightenment is a process. We'll talk more about the different levels or steps on the ladder as we go along. But for now, remember that at the bottom of the ladder, it's all about subject and object, and it's all real. So they're talking about the situation that we think we find ourselves in now, where the world is real, the world is hard, the world has consequences, and that is what I was talking about earlier, the trap or the rules, the confinement that keeps us set up in here. Is this the belief that all of this is absolutely has a real consequence, cause and effect, and that is really real? But you know, Jesus tells us in the course, you know, the main purpose of this course is to tell you that there is no world. So you know, coming to that place from a place where we absolutely believe and cannot even accept in any way at all that, you know, my life is not threatened or that I'm not vulnerable is almost impossible. So we're at the bottom of the ladder for the most part. Even if you think you're kind of up on the rungs of the ladder a little bit, all you have to do is, you know, get in a car accident or, you know, have somebody smack you in the face or something. You really quickly, even smack yourself in the face, you very quickly know what you think is real. I mean, seriously. I could do it to myself and get mad, you know, like, and then I know, oh, geez, you know, I really believe in this stuff, but to deny that is, you know, where we are, which is a lot of people who claim non-duality are, you know, into this denial of my, condition as a body. And, you know, you can see really quickly how real that is. Just get diagnosed with cancer. You know, I mean, let's not fool ourselves. So, let's see. So
can I comment on that just briefly?
Go ahead. Yeah.
I just, whenever the subject of ladders comes up nowadays, there's two thoughts that come to mind, which I find helpful. One is certainly from Ken Wapnick's teachings, and that is, he suggests that anytime you feel the least amount of martyrdom or victimhood or being at the mercy of anything that seems to be outside of you, you're forgetting that you're projection. And, you know, most certainly you're at the bottom of the ladder again with the thud, you know. and the other being that you know, when we're in the dumpster, which is, you know, below the bottom of the ladder, you know, so to speak, usually what the ego wants us to do is to hire an interior decorator to make the dumpster look prettier, you know, as a facade, rather than recognizing the stench and the horrific conditions and just climb the heck out of there, you know. So anyway, it has, and the ego's mantra is what ladder, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, that old thing, that's not safe. Don't get on there.
Yeah. I don't see a ladder. Where do you see a ladder? But pay no attention to that ladder behind the curtain.
Oh, man.
Makes me nervous.
All right. So you want to read on?
Sure. Okay. We'll be back. Persa says, we'll be back soon to tell you more about Jay and Buddha and how they knew each other. It wasn't in that many lifetimes, but it was very important to their progress. Don't forget, we've told you about how minds travel in each other's orbit. You may appear to go apart, but you're in each other's orbit. But because you're in each other's orbit, you're destined to come back together again. So it's like Ralph Waldo Emerson said, if we are related, we shall meet. Well, there's the second Emerson quote du jour. How's that? Yeah. Persa, very nice. And there's something else. The forgiveness lessons you are presented with in this lifetime are the same lessons you were presented with in other lifetimes. That's one of the reasons the Course mentions, quote, the body's serial adventures, unquote. The lessons don't look the same. things don't look the same 500 years ago as they do today, but the meaning is the same. In turn, that means, and here's some good news for you, if you could complete all your forgiveness lessons in this lifetime, you would simultaneously complete all of your forgiveness lessons in every lifetime. Gary, wow, that kind of comes back to the time-saving feature of the miracle, which I've never seen anywhere else. Art, yes, when you do your forgiveness work in this lifetime, the Holy Spirit takes that forgiveness and shines it through every lifetime that you are not aware of at the moment. The Course is correct when it says, quote, trials are but lessons that you failed to learn presented once again. So where you made a faulty choice before, you now can make a better one and thus escape all pain that what you chose before has brought you, unquote. That's not just true within the scope of one lifetime. It's true within the scope of all of them. By the way, I take it you were blown away by your UFO encounter in Hawaii. Do you want to finish the chapter?
Sure. You ain't kidding, Gary says. I had the distinct feeling we were being communicated with. Artin, you were. Gary, were they Pleiadians? Artin, you got it. They were acknowledging you, saying hello. You see, they were in the neighborhood on one of their smaller crafts. And because you were in one of their big ships before and you showed yourself to be of a peaceful mind, they considered you to be a friend. Gary, I'm in the club. Does that mean the Pleiadians and me are in each other's orbit? No pun intended. Artin. That's right. There's clearly a language barrier right now, though, so I wouldn't expect too much. They don't like to speak English, even though they understand it. So for now, just think of them as being distant relatives. No pun intended. Persa, we'll be back. So, yeah, that whole knowing that, you know, the Pleiadians are part of the script as well. You know, the Pleiadians are part of the dream that we imagined as well. And something that really came clearly to me yesterday was about the imagination of the Holy Son of God. When we made up this grand story that appears to be this huge illusion, everything that could possibly happen was made at that instant. We cannot imagine anything right now that doesn't exist actually in the script. It's because all we're doing is pulling forth the chapters where the Pleiadians occur, or the chapters where Artin and Persa are living in the same simultaneous time. There is only one time, and that's now, even in the dream. So it's not like sequential and chugga, 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 we're going along. It's actually we're simultaneously in all places at all times, because that is the nature of the illusion or the dream or the whatever you want to call it. And so don't think that, oh, this is some special thing that, you know, somehow or the other I'm in contact with this being that appears to be from another place and not human. It's all from the same place. It's all the dream, every bit of it. So, you know, and nothing in the dream surprises me anymore. because I recognize, oh, it's something we all thought up. And you know what? In the end, everyone escapes. In the end, we all live happily ever after. And we are already at the end. So all we're doing is watching what never happened. It's, you know, pretty trippy.
Yeah, it is. It's all the same stuff, isn't it?
It is. It's all the same stuff. So, so Bruce, I don't know if you wanted to go on for another half hour. We're coming up to the top of the hour.
Well, how about if we just finish this last couple of paragraphs and then pick up next time?
Okay, sounds good to me. Yeah, okay. I skipped this for the whole time, but, you know, because we usually talk anyway. But, yeah, so you want to go ahead and start the next paragraph?
Sure. Okay, so the conclusion of this first paragraph of Gary's fourth book is, and with that they were gone, referring to Art and Persa, I found myself immediately looking forward to their return. Jay and Buddha together, it was too much. During our talk, I had mentioned the time-saving feature of the miracle, and it reminded me of a quote from ACIM. Many people use the famous, quote, tiny mad idea, unquote, quote from the course, but few use the surrounding senses. As my mind started to rest, I thought of these words. Let us return the dream he gave away unto the dreamer, who perceives the dream as separate from himself and done to him. Into eternity, where all is one, there crept a tiny mad idea at which the Son of God remembered not to laugh. In his forgetting, did the thought become a serious idea and possible of both accomplishment and real effects. Together, we can laugh them both away and understand that time cannot intrude upon eternity. It is a joke to think that time can come to circumvent eternity, which means there is no time. So,
hey, isn't that what I was just saying?
That's
exactly what I was thinking, was that paragraph, and I didn't turn the page, but that's the paragraph exactly that I was thinking. Into the eternity where all is one, this a little idea came up, and we had this, we just made this thing and said, it could really be real, and we could have real effects. Real effects could happen. Yay.
Big puppet scenario,
yeah.
Huh? What a puppet show.
It's hilarious. Oh, my goodness.
It's important to remember, as Gary and his teachers point out, that beyond the illusion, there is the reality that we all are and share. And that's what I think is so important, that our forgiveness classroom really does help us anchor our identity more and more in that shared awareness, that shared understanding, and that true loving kindness that we all share, that transcends the boundaries of space and time and bodies, and truly unites us. And that's the identity that we're reestablishing, which we never left, but we appear to have dreamt it away, but it's been there all along, and we're revealing that more and more as we undo the ego.
So exactly. Thank
you for that. It's always fun, and I look forward to picking up next week where we left off today.
Outstanding. Thank you so much, Bruce, Rob, and I have figured out now how to get post recordings on my website.
Oh,
and
great.
So doing that now. I upgraded the ACIM Gather website so that we can post recordings on there from all of us. I may take you up on the thought of maybe a little bit of coaching maybe on
sure.
the WordPress.
Oh. Sure. Let me know. And please send me the links and let me know how I can help. And thanks to everyone, and including you, of course, Lynn, and have a great week.
All right. Thank you, Bruce Rawls. Blessings.
Likewise. Bye for now.